Okay, good evening, everyone. We're broadcasting live November 17th or so, 2015. Last night I was away. We had a interfaith cafe, or what's it called? Anyway, they had coffee and Timbits, I think. You know what Timbits are? Those donut holes. Or maybe they had donuts as well, I don't know. It was an interesting time, but I felt out of place, really, because with the exception of maybe one group, it was all about God. That was the whole thing. In interfaith, I'm not sure why I'm there, because faith isn't a big part of my religion. If it was interreligious dialogue, that would be something, but it was interfaith, which already prejudices it against reason. Maybe not even reason, because we're not into reason so much. I'm learning that there's, in philosophy, they already have words for this. There's the rationalists, and then there's the empiricists. The Buddha was an empiricist. See, there is something useful to going to school. You learn all sorts of neat words. But it's biased against things like rationality and empiricism. Because faith is supposed to be the highest. So the idea is you can have different faiths, but it was about bridging, and it was really disappointing because for the most part they weren't trying to bridge anything. For the most part it was presentations. I mean, I didn't stay for the chat afterwards. Everyone was set up in their own space and people would go around, I guess, and chat. But I didn't really feel like staying because there was too much God. But when everyone came and did their presentations, it was all, our religion is the way, the best, and if you don't follow it, you go to hell, basically. Some version of that, either that or... The Muslims said all the answers, everything you need is in the Quran. I mean, it's basically promotion, self-promotion, which, I don't know, it doesn't really seem like it was disappointing. The only thing that was interesting was the Jewish group, the on-campus Judaism society called Mac Hillel. Hillel was apparently a Jewish rabbi who said something neat. He said the whole of the Torah can be summed up by the golden rule, which is, don't do unto others what is undesired, what you don't desire for yourself or something. So don't hurt others. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you, that kind of thing. And so they seem neat, you know, if that's what their religion is about, I think that's awesome. And then I got up. I was the second last guy to go. I was the token Buddhist. And I sat up on this table, because I'd done this before, but I'd done it on desks before. I'd sat up on desks in classrooms. But then I got this bright idea to sit on a bar table. I got on it and it goes like this, and half the audience gets up, is ready to grab the table for me. So I sat down and taught meditation, but I think a lot of their attention was distracted because it was swaying. And then after I finished, I tried to get off and someone ran over to it. I was really, probably should have been a bit more mindful about that.
Maybe they thought you were going to begin levitating, Bhante.
Well, they could see it tip more than I. I didn't realize that it was tipping so much, but it was really disturbing the audience. But once I started teaching, it was really neat. You know, they had all their things. But once I started teaching meditation, they were perfectly quiet. So I don't know if they were meditating. I said, you don't have to. This is a presentation. So I'm going to present meditation to you. If you want to follow, you can. And it shouldn't conflict with your beliefs. And if you want to use it for whatever, praising God or whatever, that's fine. It just makes your mind stronger and clearer. So I did a meditation on clearing the mind, which is our meditation. And then I said, once your mind is clear, you can use it to send love. So then I did a love meditation, loving kindness. So I think that was, it was nice to be able to do that, but that was all. And today I taught, well, I was our normally scheduled meditation downstairs. I taught someone to do meditation because they had another peace thing today. A lot of peace stuff interested. People are interested in peace because there's concern of war, right? So that's my news. Robin, your news? You want to tell everyone your news?
Our news is we had started an online campaign 3 months ago to establish the money to the funds to start up the Seri Mongluo International Monastery and Meditation Center, and our goal was met yesterday, $12,000, which is just a great, wonderful support from this community. So thank you, everyone. We have closed the campaign at this time. We still have a support page on SeriMongluo.org for anyone who would like to continue to support these efforts. But that goal was met, which is great. We also had a second campaign, which was to provide funds to offer a robe to Bhante. And that campaign also was greatly successful. We actually generated far more than was needed to purchase a robe. And we were able to generate enough funds to provide a secondary gift to Wat Khmer Krom, which is where Bhante used to reside before he established his own monastery. So we were able to donate a total of 1,245 Canadian dollars to their fund. And good news on the robe, it has been completed and it's being mailed from Thailand to Canada as we speak. So once it gets there, we'll plan a little ceremony. And that leads me to a question, Bhante. The woman in Thailand that has been assisting me with placing this order, she said, "Be sure to say the special words to Venerable Yutadhamma when you offer the robe." I don't know what those special words are.
Oh, you don't know the secret word.
I don't know the secret words.
You don't know the secret handshake either.
No, I don't know any of this.
Disgraceful.
Yes, I
Well,
am a first-timer.
you want to
This
know
is
a
my
secret? You
first-timer
want to know the
robe
secret?
offer.
I haven't a clue what secret words she's talking about, so.
Oh, okay. I'll ask
Special
her then.
words. Special words.
So
Well,
when.
there is a ceremony when you offer. So it may be that she's referring to the they have a formula for offering in Pali.
Oh, okay.
Imani mayam bhante tichivarani sapparivarani patigan bhikkhu sanghasa onochayama. That's if you're offering it to the sangha. Which you could do.
Okay.
You could offer it to the Sangha with me on behalf, but it gets a little complicated, I think, then. Because, well, I mean, I could designate myself as the recipient, but it's coming to me. This is Pugalika Dana, which means you're offering to a person. Katina
Okay.
Dana is not, actually, Katina Dana. No, Katina Dana, when you give robes for the Katina, you're giving it to the Sangha, and the Sangha is the one who gives it to the person. So that's a different, that's actually considered better because you're giving it to the Sangha as a whole. You're supporting Buddhism. Here you're just supporting a person.
Okay.
So you wouldn't use that for that general phrasing that they use.
Okay.
But that's all just formula. It's useful. Formula is useful to keep people's attention and so on, but it's just formula.
Okay, thank you, Bhante.
Thank you for getting me a new robe. Someone yesterday, one of the Hillel people, the Jewish people, said, "Do people stare at you when when you walk around in campus like that?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." And he said, "How does that make you feel?" And I said, "Well, what am I going to do?" And he said, and then I said, "Well, actually, there is something I'm doing. I'm getting a darker colored robe." Because I understand the sentiment. When I was in California, in Moorpark, California, this guy, sort of middle-aged man in a big pickup truck. Hey, help me out here. And I thought he really needed my help, actually. I thought it was something was needing to help lift something, or I don't know. And then he started to, his question was something like, don't you know that you're attracting a lot of attention or something? And I said, well, that's not really my concern. And but he couldn't hear me because my voice was very quiet and his truck was very loud, and we were at a gas station. We were actually in front of this gas station that he pulled in, and then there's this guy cutting the weeds, who stops cutting the weeds and joins in the conversation and starts telling me about how great Jesus is. America's a weird place. I've got stories. But he said something, the old guy said, so you don't work, or so you don't work or something. And I said, yes, I work. What? I work. I teach. I'm a teacher. What? I'm a teacher. I don't know. I don't remember. And then I think he wanted to go on, and I said, look, I was on my way. I was on Omzur, and I said, look, I don't really want to talk about this, because the other guy started saying, Jesus is the way. And I said, look, I'm not really interested in this. I have somewhere I have to be. And so and I think he was the old guy who tried to stop me, if I remember correctly. He was like calling me back, hey. And I just walked away. And it wasn't a wholesome conversation.
No. But on the bright side, if there are Buddhists around, they can spot you very easily.
But that would be a silly reason to wear a robe. I mean, it's not meant to be
No.
flashy.
It's just one of the side benefits if there happen to be Buddhists around.
Well, I think people will still recognize. I won't be unrecognizable just because I changed the color, but in a crowd, it'll stand out less. There have been times where it's good to stand out. If I'm waiting for someone at the airport, or if I'm arriving at the airport and someone's picking me up, I'm really easy to spot. But I don't think that is the intention. I
Yeah.
don't think that's, hey, let's make the robe really easy to really stand so that it stands out. I don't think that was at all the idea. It's about, that would be the opposite of leading to humility, contentment. You don't really want people staring at you,
No.
I think. Yeah, you want people who see you and say, wow, a Buddhist monk, that's kind of neat. That's a good thing, I think.
Yeah.
So we have a quote, and we were just talking, and I said I'd wait until we actually started broadcasting to talk about this. But Robin said she liked the quote. I like the quote. This is a quote I heard very early on, like a few months after. I think it's in the What the Buddha Taught. I think he quotes this. But often people, I think there's a sense, I often feel that a sense of people kind of using this or extrapolating upon this to say there's no real reason to respect the Dhamma. It's just a raft, it's just a tool. But that's not what the Buddha is saying. So some people will think of the Dhamma as just an ordinary tool, and so they don't respect it, they don't take it seriously, and they don't feel like it should be religious or something like that. It's something to be discarded, right? And if people talk about the Dhamma, they say, well, the Dhamma is just a raft, it's just a tool, don't hold on to it, kind of thing. But that's not what the Buddha is saying at all. And in fact, what I would bet is the Buddha's focus, because as a meditation teacher, it comes up a lot, is referring to in the meditation practice when good things occur, right? So first of all, the ordinary ones, when happiness comes and you hold on to that, but even more and more difficult is when you hold on to knowledge. So people will often say things like, I had a clear understood realization of impermanence, or I had a clearer realization of suffering or non-self. And this happens a lot. People say these things, or people say, I think I realized Nirvana or something. And it's true. It could be true. And it's true, certainly, that people have experiences, realizations of impermanent suffering and non-self. That's what the purpose of it is. But they overestimate it, and they say, "Oh, that's," and then they hold on to it. You see, and they'll sit there and they'll mull it over, and they'll try to bring it back. They'll recreate the experience, so to speak. They'll look and try to see it again, and that kind of thing. And they stop meditating. They're not being mindful anymore. So that is very clearly what is being talked about in this. That's an example of what's being talked here. What about here? People hold on to knowledge. Yeah, I learned something. Buddhism? Oh yeah, I learned all that. You get this sense, like, especially as monks, you get a sense that you know it all, because you've learned it all, and maybe you've meditated and realized some things. But it's a raft, and what you don't want to do is throw the raft away halfway across the river. So really, this simile only really applies. Well, it only really applies to once you've realized that anything you've realized. Once you've realized something, then you should throw it away. You don't need to go back to it. That realization is complete. You shouldn't hold on to it or depend upon it. And mostly it's just mundane. But if you realize Nibbana, then that is something you can depend upon. I think that's a different example that you have to be careful. It's easy to overestimate. But it happens. People do realize Nibbana, and it can happen during the course. I assume it could even happen during these courses that we're doing, where people do a few hours a day. Could happen. Can happen during daily life. It's not common, but the realization of Sotapanna could happen, depending on the person. Some people, it just takes a little bit of a push. But that's different, because you can't hold on to it. Sotapanna is not something you can even think about, because it's realization of Nibbana is something you can't cling to. You can't cling to Nibbana. It's not. There's no memory, no perception of it that you could cling to. You can cling to the idea of it, sure. But we cling to good things. We cling to knowledge. We cling to happiness. We cling to calm. All of which are good. Even look at the seven bodhjhanas. So people cling to knowledge, they cling to effort. When they're energetic, they cling to it. Cling to rapture, states of rapture or excitement, ecstasy. They cling to states of tranquility, they cling to concentration, equanimity. We cling to state, cling to things. This is like a person who has used the raft and then holds on to it and carries it with them. But it's clearest, I think, with knowledge. I think that's where, and that's really what he's talking about, the Dhamma, right? Good Dhammas. So these knowledges. It doesn't mean you should denigrate or marginalize, or not marginalize, what's it called? You should take the Dhamma seriously. It is a raft, and it's going to help you, it's going to save your life, it's going to help you cross the river, cross the ocean. So that's sort of my take on the quote. Questions? Still there, Robin?
Yes, and I think we have questions. I try not to be cynical, I really do, but take Friday's incident as an example. Looking at the facts, it appears that the authorities knew about the attack beforehand, but for some strange reason did nothing to prevent it. Hearing today's news that France is now at war with Syrian rebels, I can't help but think cynically. Problem, reaction, solution, especially hearing all the media reaction to this. Anyhow, my question is, if it's true and the authorities allowed this to happen, how can one be mindful and find happiness at the given moment? I can't help but feel like a cynic. What can I do to try and turn my mind around so I can accept the situation?
Well, stop thinking about it, I guess. Stop fixating so much on it. And then I think the news does that to us. We get, it's designed like all things designed for public consumption is designed to inflame the mind, right? So the news isn't designed to make you peace, make you calm. That doesn't sell papers or whatever it is the equivalent today, subscriptions. That doesn't get page views.
Mm-hmm.
So news is, I mean, really, the news and media right now is kind of, they're kind of freaking out because they're not making money really anymore as much as they used to anyway, because people get their news from all sorts of sources. So they're trying whatever they can to make money. Online advertising doesn't really work that well, you know, that kind of thing. My point being that it's really, I think it's a circus. It was always called, media was always called, well, the circus, but it's even more of a circus now. It's like the clown car. Is it? I don't want to, I mean, I don't know. I don't watch the news. I just look at headlines usually. So I don't know. But I hear.
Yeah, the bombings in Paris have had 24-hour coverage since Friday, and it's Tuesday. And on some of the news channels, it's just been 24-hour coverage of it. It's so definitely, if you're going to sit there and listen to it, it's not that helpful.
Yeah, and then you wonder, like, well, wasn't that the point of the whole thing on it, for the people who committed it, was to make us obsessed with, you know, afraid, and terrorism makes to cripple you.
Yes. And it's true that good news doesn't sell. We had a paper here in our town for a short while that only had good news, and they gave it away free. It was just paid for by advertising. But even at that, they couldn't stay in business with only good news.
Yeah, because the reason you want to hear news is when there's a problem. It's like a lot of things. The only time you want to practice meditation is when you got problems. That kind of thing.
Hi, Bhante. When I do sitting meditation, sometimes I jump when I hear a sound. Sometimes I jump for no reason. It's like I'm falling and try to catch myself after. When I experience that, I know anxious, because I feel anxious that happens. Am I doing anything wrong? Why do I jump?
Who is
it
that?
It happens. Pardon?
Who is this?
This is Ricola. Oh. It happens more often at the end of meditation. I meditate 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's actually, we would find that an indication of one of the stages of knowledge. So it could be that you're actually progressing through the knowledges or having an experience. But I don't want to go into too much detail. It's not something that you should really concern with. But either way, it's not something you should be concerned about. And you can know that it happens to meditators. You feel like you're falling and you catch yourself. It's a sign of fairly strong concentration. You know, because normally you catch yourself all the time, right? We readjust all the time. But when you get really focused on, say, the rising, falling, or on what you're doing, you don't catch it until it's strong enough to make you think that you're actually going to fall. And moreover, depending on your state of mind, yeah, it can freak you out so that you actually... that happens. It's just an experience. I wouldn't put too much weight on it.
How to know when there's a lot going on simultaneously? Sometimes sense perceptions or feelings. Once I was experiencing both liking and disliking at the same time, while smelling two different smells and the same sniffing, or seeing, hearing, and the reaction, anxious, liking, disliking, frustrated. I've tried to randomly choose one or two to switch between them very quickly, but not sure what is best. Is there a strategy to prioritize the choice of noting?
It's really kind of surprising how often I get this phrase, experiencing two things at once. Do you logically understand what it would take to experience two things, to really experience two things at once? I mean, doesn't it strike you as odd? Doesn't it strike everyone as odd when you think about it, that you could possibly experience? What would it mean to have two real experiences at once, two distinct experiences at once? We're just studying Locke. We're just reading Locke today, John Locke, and he goes on about this, and maybe this is why he does. I didn't understand. He seems very long-winded, and that's what they say he is. But he's very interesting, and he says that two things, if they happen at the same time in the same place, must be the same thing. They can't be two things. What he means to say, and how I think it relates, is that it's impossible to have two distinct things occur at the same time, in the same place. And in this case, the place is the mind. How could you experience two things at once? What would that mean? Yeah. It would mean there are two of you. And which one of you experienced which? And how do you know that you experienced both? When this one experienced this and this one experienced that. Yeah. I mean, maybe it's not a perfect logical argument that I'm giving, but it seems terribly illogical and unreasonable to suggest. But I think you have to think about it. It doesn't maybe come naturally that thought. I think, well, perhaps we don't ponder the mind enough or really understand or get a sense of what's really happening and what reality is really like. There's no way that you could possibly experience two things at once. So that, I just wanted to say that. But regardless, it's not really an important point, a little bit important, but it does allow me to say that you'll still only note whichever one is present because they're not present at the same time. You're just not able to see that they're happening one after the other. And you have to. That's the only way experience can occur. It has to be one experience at a time. It's just so fast that our brain is doesn't have the realization, okay, that happened, then that happened. It processes it kind of thinking, oh, it's all happening at once. But it's not. So the thought arises, it's all happening at once. But the experience, if you look closely and if you persevere in your practice, you'll see experiences necessarily occur one at a time.
So,
So what to do? Yeah, I wouldn't switch between them very quickly. Pick one, whichever one is at any moment prevalent, and just note it. You don't even have to have a reason for choosing. Just choose whatever one seems like, grab at something that's clear and just note it when it's gone. When it's gone, then go back to the rising and falling. But if something else comes, go back to it, and then again go back to the rising. But yeah, you prioritize based on clarity, whichever one is most prominent.
There's something wrong with constant mental noting. How can one mentally note the present moment if it changes by the time you note it? Why not just have a constant awareness, a concentration on the ever-changing present moment, on ultimate reality?
But we are constantly aware. Dogs are constantly aware. What's the difference between a dog knowing that it walks and a meditator that knows it when they're walking? It's not what mindfulness is. Mindfulness is not just knowing what you're doing. In fact, we can't just know what we're doing because we don't have mindfulness. Mindfulness is that what grasps the object and keeps the mind fixed on it, not wavering. Because we don't naturally know, we can't just naturally know. We have so much baggage, and it really takes a bit of time to really get to get that in your practice. you'll start to see how deeply rooted are our delusions. But you can only see that when you use this artifice, kind of to pry the lid off of the mind or to pull the mind back, like the Buddha said, like a tree leaning in the wrong direction. You have to really yank on it. And only when you get it in the right direction do you, does it, will it fall in the right place. So I guarantee that you can't. Well, some people can become enlightened fairly easily without fairly form, without, you know, if the tree's already kind of leaning in the right direction, all you need is sometimes a little push. But if you're leaning in the wrong direction, then you need an artifice, and that's what meditation is. It's an artifice to realign the mind. The mind is naturally, but habitually, wrong. So it grasps things with ego, with attachment, with delusion. And so you have to pry it and yank it, pull it in the other direction.
Hi, Bhante. Is it common to spend most of the time of sitting meditation noting sensations and thoughts different from the rising and falling? Because today my mind is focused mostly on experiences different from the rising and falling.
That's not wrong. You might want to note distracted, distracted, or if you're overwhelmed, overwhelmed. You might want to keep those in mind. They might help you come back to the rising and falling. As long as you're coming back whenever there's nothing, if you quickly get carried away, that's not a problem. Yeah, it is a bit of a problem, but you know, it's what we have to deal with because of our lives and work and that kind of thing. So you train yourself, and eventually it gets better.
Hello, Bhante. Can sitting meditation gradually help improve bad eyesight, vision?
When I started meditating, I thought it might fix my teeth. Isn't that absurd? Sorry, I shouldn't be laughing, but it is kind of funny. We're kind of silly that way. You have a yellow or orange, Jacques, you have an orange question mark. You know what that means? It means you haven't done any meditation. So no answer for you. Sorry. Yeah, we're discriminatory that way.
Greetings from the UK. I was wondering if you could talk a little on the aspect of traveling abroad to learn more about the Dhamma or for intensive meditation courses. I'm interested to hear about any particularly important parts of the process that you underwent before becoming a bhikkhu. So my question is, would you recommend a similar path for as many able meditators as possible, or should one first learn as much as possible in his or her own country before considering this at all? P.S. I'm new to Sirimangalo, but not to your channel. Your videos are clear, insightful, and have been an excellent resource for me and my ongoing Dhamma study. Thank you, Bhante.
Matthew, if you want to make a question mark, it's question colon, and you can do just push the green question mark button in the bottom left, and that'll give you the code. Well, thank you for watching my videos. That's pretty awesome. It's neat that people are finding them helpful. See, my path was not about becoming a bhikkhu, although for a long time I wanted to become a monk. And even after I meditated, I wanted to become a monk. But I think that's distinct, and I don't think that's as nearly as important or as useful. It was more about going to meditate. Now, the great thing about Asia is they have awesome meditation centers. Facilities are great. I don't recommend people to go to my monastery because there's not the greatest situation in my mind as far as teaching goes. But I suppose that's not quite fair. There is teaching there. I mean, I had a real hard time because eventually I kind of had a falling out with my first teacher that I think still hasn't been resolved. But so that group is a little bit, I mean, there's a lot of people who have problems with them. I'm not the only one. So I don't know where you'd go, is my point. And moreover, that centers in the West tend to be have their own problems. Like our center, for example, it's nothing like a center. It's nowhere near. We have a house, which is not the greatest. But you have this place called Satipanya. If you go to Satipanya in the UK, I think it's a similar tradition. And from the sounds of it, the teacher is really great. So I'd recommend you could go there. I don't think you need to go to Asia, and you certainly don't need to become a monk or worry too much about that. If you're going to become a monk, it'll come naturally to you. It'll just make itself known, and you'll become a monk. I think that's a better way of looking at it than all these people who want to become a monk. All these people, well, people whose it's easy to become fixated on that aspect. And I'd encourage people not to reconsider and to focus more on the meditation aspect, because people are ordained as a monk and don't realize the difficulty, and they disrobe quite quickly. Maybe not after a week, but after a month or 3 months or half a year. It's very hard if you're not, into meditation, and moreover, if it's not just natural that you are a monk, you are monk-like in your thinking. And again, I think it's a bit misleading, because being a monk isn't the most important aspect.
We're all caught up on those questions. So just a brief question from me, similar to the other question about is there anything special you should say when offering a robe? Is there anything special you should say when offering food to a monk?
I mean, Buddhism doesn't have these special things. So you can make them up, and people have made them up. Ajahn Dong does it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. It's great for people who are keen on it. But, do you want to do it the Thai way, or do you want to do it the Sri Lankan way, or do you want to do it the Burmese way, or the Lao way, or the Cambodian way? Because I've got lots of different ways you can say special things to.
Okay, we'll say the Lao way, because I've been going on Mondays to bring lunch to the monks and the nun at a Laotian temple. I'm never quite sure what to say, or if anything.
So you don't know what they say?
I just bring the food out and set it down and do this, but I don't say anything. I don't know if I'm supposed to say anything.
No, so in fact, they only do it when they do ceremony. So in Sri Lanka, they do it because, well, no, not to the monks actually, but they do it. Sri Lanka has a whole thing for the Buddha when they offer food to the Buddha. But in Thailand and really everywhere, it's not about when you give, it's about when you have a ceremony. So they only use these
Okay.
special things when they have it. Which I guess is what you're talking about, right? Having a ceremony. So, I mean, I could make one up for you,
No, I just wanted to make sure I wasn't making a silly mistake by not saying
No, I mean,
anything.
think about how monks are supposed to get robes and how the Buddha recommended that we try to find robes in trash heaps. There's no ceremony there.
Very true.
So what people trying to make merit would do is they'd throw the robe away in the place where the monk was known to walk. So when there's a path from the forest to the village, they would throw robes, they hang them over tree branches, or just drop them in the path. Because many monks would refuse to accept gifts of robes. They wanted to live with contentment, taking only rags, only scraps, only castaways. So that's why when on my birthday one time in California, we went around to nine monasteries and offered nine sets of robes. And I had a whole caravan of people following me. It was kind of fun. But they followed and they expected ceremony. So we'd get to the monastery and I'd drop the robe off and try to sneak away without anyone seeing us. And that's the exact opposite of what was expected. Everyone was wondering what was going on. Where did he go? Why did he leave? Why is the robe sitting there? I got to the monastery, someone would say, "Okay, I'll go and get the abbot." No, don't go and get the abbot. We're just going to drop it off and leave. What? No, wait, we'll get him. No, you don't understand.
So is that part of the Buddhist custom of giving things away on your birthday? Giving gifts to others on your birthday?
Yeah, well, I mean, not in the Buddhist time. I can't think of. Maybe, yeah, even still then, there was the case. Tomorrow's Dhammapada is related. Right? Tomorrow we're doing Dhammapada? Hopefully.
Yes. The
We'll see
one
if
we've
I
been
can.
waiting for a few days now.
We'll see if I can't find something else to occupy my evening. No, I'll try to be here. But it's definitely a long-standing tradition on your birthday to give gifts, invite monks, that kind of thing. Like on Ajahn Tong's birthday, you don't believe what he gives away. He gave away like 500 refrigerators one year, 500, several hundred. Not full size, but in Thailand they don't use full size refrigerators anyway. They use smaller refrigerators. But every monk got a refrigerator, hundreds of them. And it was just. It's just a matter of every year trying to outdo last year. This is kind of neat. Not that I
That's
really think
awesome.
monks need refrigerators, but.
So you go to see Ajahn Chung for his birthday and you leave carting a refrigerator.
Yeah, it was funny. Some people were like, "What am I going to do with this?" But you could see getting them in the
Yeah.
back of a three-wheeler.
Particularly considering you're not supposed to save food overnight, what would you do with a
Well,
refrigerator?
monasteries. Most of the monks were abbots or that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
But no, many monks have refrigerators in their rooms and keep all sorts of stuff. I shouldn't say that, but it's the truth, and we shouldn't hide it. Some monks would disagree. They think we should hide it because we don't want people to get a bad impression. But if monks aren't being called to account, then,
Thank you, Bhante. And with that, we're all caught up for questions.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Bhante.
Thanks, everyone, tuning in. Have a good night.
Good night.